some people here know that for some years I've had a bit of an interest in Sufism, and I want to start by mentioning a story about a very great Central Asian Sufi named Najmuddin Kubra, the founder of the Kubravi order. Very great Sufi, great contemplative, and when you actually look at his descriptions of these meditations and the path he talks about, you do detect an influence of Buddhism on him. But anyway, one time in his life he was sojourning, as the text has it, in Egypt, and he was staying on the banks of the Nile, and he fell passionately in love with a very, very beautiful Egyptian slave girl, intensely in love. Overwhelmingly in love. And being a proper Sufi, not a pretend Sufi, he didn't do anything about this with the beautiful, astonishingly beautiful Egyptian slave girl. He did what you should do if you're a proper Sufi. He fasted for 40 days. He went into a sort of Ramadan period, went into retreat, and intensively meditated on the names of the truth, the names of Allah, like mantra recitation. And the experience of love, therefore, became even more intense, even more overwhelming, even more powerful, until he had the experience of flames pouring out of him, pouring out of his chest, surging up into the heavens, great flames of love moving upwards towards the real. And then, lo and behold, strangely, there was a response. There were flames descending, pouring down from some unknown space. And then the flames met and formed a being, a new kind of being. And Najmuddin Kubra said, "Who are you?" And the figure replied, the mysterious angel-like figure replied, "I am your witness in heaven. I am your supra-celestial spiritual guide." It's a wonderful story, wonderful image, wonderful vision of flames shooting up into space and then there being a response. But it all comes out of love. It all comes out of transformed love, the transmutation of intense desire, the transmutation of even the response to beauty, so that it becomes a response to ultimate beauty, the beauty of the absolute. And this story has occurred to me because today we're talking, in the talk that I'm doing this evening, on positive emotion. Positive emotion, the second great stage in Sangharakshita's great stages of the path. Yesterday we heard, day before yesterday, we heard about the first stage, the stage of awareness, integration, mindfulness. And today we're on the second stage, positive emotion. And this story illustrates, I think, very well the importance of intensely positive emotion in spiritual life, not just for Sufis, but for Buddhists also. For Buddhists also, it's incredibly important to be passionately, emotionally involved in your Dharma life. Because the sheer fact of the matter is, we are creatures of desire. We're desiderative beings. We are here in this world, living the lives that we live because of our desire. We're not actually kept going by abstract ideas, by thoughts. We act instinctively. We act on the basis of our desires, our deep sanskaras, those deep forces that have brought us into this world, this wheel of life. And as you know, in the wheel of life, after feeling, there comes craving. Craving for not just sensual things, but craving for existence. There's even a sort of craving for non-existence. And after that, there is grasping and attachment. And after that, there's bhava or becoming. This is all showing the force, the power of desire. Come in, welcome. I'm just talking about the force and power of desire.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. So it's very important that we engage with that, that we do something with it, that we engage with it. I think that there is a sort of problem that affects some people in relation to Buddhism. They approach Buddhism in far too cool a fashion, even think that Buddhism, you know, that emotions have no place in Buddhism. You'll even find translations of the term klesha, which is more properly translated as defilement, translated as emotion. And the kleshas are negative. The kleshas are regarded as things to rid yourself of. The Buddha is somebody free from kleshas. In some translations, it will seem to suggest that the Buddha doesn't have any emotions. Well, this is nonsense, and this is a very, very poor translation of the word klesha. Sangharakshita insists that emotions have to be involved in Dharma life. They have to be transformed. They have to be transmuted if we're to have a serious Dharma life. As I say, we're not kept going by abstract ideas. It's our emotions that move us. It's our emotions that get us out of bed in the morning or make us stay there in the morning. It's our emotions that get us on retreat. It's our emotions that will keep us on retreat. It's our emotions that will keep us meditating in the end. It's our emotions that will lead us indeed to enlightenment. So we need to get hold of our emotions. And when I say getting hold of our emotions, transforming our emotions, we mean transforming them into positive emotions. Negative emotions need to be purified. They need to be overcome. Hatred, jealousy, pride, craving, fear, all these sorts of negative emotions, they need to be purified if we're to make any real progress. And we need to develop love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, faith, devotion, and so on. I mean, in a way, probably this is all, you know, quite familiar to you. We're doing the Metta Bhavana twice a day at the moment. And I think, you know, perhaps there's no need to say very much about metta and positive emotion, because we're actually doing it. We're actually making some effort to develop that emotion. But I do want to say a few things around this area before getting on to the main part of the talk. I was rereading Sangharakshita's lecture on perfect emotion, which is the second limb of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And he says some very momentous things here. He said for most of us, and when I say most, I actually think he means all, you know, unless you're, you know, pretty a long way along the path. For most of us, the central issue of the spiritual life is to find emotional equivalents to intellectual understanding. The central issue of the Dharma life, the spiritual life, is to find emotional equivalents to intellectual understanding. Actually, he had this insight, I think, in his late teens, judging by some of the essays that he wrote back in India in the very early days of his Dharma life. It's one of the reasons why I'm a disciple of Sangharakshita, because of this insight, because of this phrase. It's so simple, it's so direct. The central problem of the Dharma life for most people is to find emotional equivalents to intellectual understanding. I can sit here and I could give you probably one of the best talks you've ever heard on Metta Bhavana. I really could. I'm not saying that with any arrogance. I know I could actually do a very good talk for you on Metta Bhavana. I could explain it. I could go into it. I could talk about all the sort of blockages to Metta. I could even get very poetic about the end of Metta. It's a very different thing for me to actually embody that, to experience that, to live that all the time in everything that I do. That just shows the disparity between having a way with words and a quick mind and the actual emotional place that I occupy. Fortunately, I do know that. I am aware of that disparity. But you know, many of us are like this. We know the truth. We know the truth. All of you here, I should think, know everything you need to know in order to get enlightened. You know, I bet you if we sat down and we talked about what are the essential elements to gain enlightenment, you could probably all conjugate it. You could probably all say it. But can you do it? Can you actually live it? You could probably say why it's good to have metta in your life, but can you do it? Can you actually have constant loving kindness for everybody you meet? Well, maybe you can. I hope if you can, please tell me how to do it, how to live it. But our emotions lag so far behind. And one of the things that's very, very noticeable about the modern world is how much it runs on ideas. Which means it runs on ideas, but it doesn't mean that we're really living it. Loads and loads of ideas, loads and loads of sort of imagery, loads and loads of information. But it doesn't really mean that we're living a life, a really full-blooded life, full of rich emotion, rich experience. Just an enormous amount of information. You know, and information technology has made it even worse. So people can be experts on all kinds of things. It doesn't mean that they're a fantastic human being. It doesn't mean that they're a human being with real, you know, life, with real positive emotion, making a real difference to themselves and their world. So we need to really address this. We really need to look into this. And it could be that on a retreat like this, you might start finding, to your surprise, that, you know, you came here with very, very good intentions, very, you know, fine expectations of getting into very positive emotional states and so on. But you might find that that's not happening. You might be finding that the emotional states that you're discovering in yourself through meditation are sort of self-pity, one of mine, grumpiness, you know, sort of that kind of mentally complaining going on all the time. Don't like him, don't like the rusty coat he wears, don't like that, don't like this, don't like the food, don't like that, the way they're leading that and the way he's ringing the bells, that sort of thing. You know, you might find, or you're just sort of dead emotionally, or a bit sort of depressed, or a lot of ill will, or a lot of anger, or whatever it might be. Very good. That is success. Yes, you're finding out what's really going on, what's really there. You know, you're not sort of, you know, wonderfully part. Some of you might actually be finding that you're just blissed out and there's just a wonderful flow of love and joy and some fantastic. That's what you're like at the moment. Don't get carried away. Don't get conceited. Don't get complacent. But, you know, you're discovering what's actually there. That's what a retreat does. It's interesting, the Zen name for retreat, Sesshin, means something like searching the heart, I think. Searching the heart. And that's what we're doing. Any retreat is like that. You're really searching the heart, finding out what is going on in your emotional body. What's actually there, rather than what you think is there, rather than what you'd like to be there. It's absolutely brilliant, a retreat like this, especially doing lots of metta bhavana, because you're really confronted with yourself in that practice. That's why it's such a fantastic practice, such a wonderful sort of insight practice, because you find out, yes, I like him, I'm indifferent to him, and I hate him, and him, and her, and that, etc., etc. Fantastic. You know, there is no possibility of development by closing your eyes to where you are actually emotionally. But the other wonderful thing is that you can change it. You can actually change it. It does actually work. I mean, this is certainly my experience of metta bhavana over the years. You know, the number of times I've been on I've been on a retreat, and there's always a few people that I just don't like the look of. You know, and I'm sure they don't like the look of me. You know, I know it's not. You know, don't take it personally. You think I'm talking about you? I'm sure I've been on the end of it as well. You know, well, you know, why not? You know, I don't like their shape, or I don't like their face, or I don't know, their smell or the way they make tea or the way they eat, whatever it might be. You put them in that fourth stage. Or, you know, there's just those sort of people that you, you know, they're kind of cut-out people that you just sort of pass, the sort of neutral. But I hope this isn't just me. I hope I'm not the only one. I hope I'm not projecting. Maybe it is. Anyway, it's a confession, isn't it? So there's that neutral person. But the thing is, it changes. It gloriously changes. You know, slowly, slowly. And as Satyaraja wisely said, it doesn't just happen in the meditation. The meditation might seem particularly sort of crusty and knobbly and bland and nothing going on. But you've sat there, you've held that person in your mind. Yes, you've even said those phrases. Maybe you thought, well, this is all a bit, you know, I'm just saying them. Maybe happy, maybe well, maybe free from suffering. Why am I saying this? It's not making any... All right, no, maybe happy, maybe well. And you kind of look for the nice thing about, well, you know, they've got a nice smile, actually, you know, and things like that. And maybe nothing happens in the meditation, but afterwards, you notice, suddenly, you're in the front room with them, in the lounge with them, you're sitting on the sofa with them, and you're having a really lovely conversation with them. A really lovely conversation. Well, that's got to be something to do with the metta-bhavana. That's not an accident. Maybe, of course, they've been doing metta to you because actually it's mutual. You know, they haven't liked the look of you. I think that's quite possible. You know, so there's all this sort of magic that can go on, you know, on a retreat. So it does happen. You can actually transform this negativity into positivity. And it's important to become more and more vigorous in this positive emotion, really important for all sorts of reasons. I mean, one reason for this is that we need to become robust in our Dharma life. I use that phrase, emotional body. A lot of people have very fragile emotional bodies. They're very easily pushed around. Probably we all are in one way or another. You know, we hit any difficulty in the Dharma life, it's, oh, I can't go on. Oh, catastrophe, you know, I'm leaving, you know, I'm the worst sinner ever. We all do it. I do it. I felt really, I tell you, I felt so crappy today. I felt so awful today. I didn't know how I was going to give a talk this evening. I just felt uncomfortable, you know, miserable, fed up. The only good practice has been the metta-bhavana. You know, it happens to the best of us. I felt really rubbish. But the thing is, you need to be robust. You need to be really robust. And positive emotion does this. You develop a strong emotional body. I think sometimes the way people can approach the Dharma life, especially with an overemphasis on a certain sort of preciousness around mindfulness, people become almost neurotic. You know, they become much too oversensitive. And any kind of difficulty, they're blown around by it. Any kind of difficulty, they're grown this way and that, and they've got to only eat special foods or, you know, have things set up in a particular way. That is not what a Dharma practitioner is. A Dharma practitioner is somebody with really robust emotion. Sangharakshita, in his lecture on the system of meditation, says that our positive emotion should be really hot. Hot, that's the word he used. Very, very strongly positive, you know, for the people around us. So we have strong friendships in the Sangha. Really strong friendships. Not exclusive friendships. Friendships that we're extending to include more and more people. We have strong devotion. Strong devotion to our teachers, our spiritual friends, to the Buddhas, to the Bodhisattvas. Remember Najmuddin's cobra's flame shooting up to him, to reality. Well, you know, he was a Muslim, so we should have it even stronger to the Buddha because it's more real, it's more true than that. Should be very, very intense, very, very strong. So, and one of the reasons for this, it doesn't, we're not blown around by what happens. When we gain transcendental insight, wisdom into the way things really are, then we become Vajra-like, then we become diamond hard, then we won't be blown around by anything. Until that point, we need lots of mindfulness, lots of metta, lots of awareness, lots of positive emotion, so that we're not blown around by what happens, what throws us around. I was thinking, or I wasn't thinking, it was an image that came up this afternoon in the storm. There was a storm outside, and I can assure you there was a storm inside with me. And the image that came up was this wonderful story of Milarepa. Before his enlightenment, Milarepa, the great Tibetan yogi, and it was this snowstorm, this endless snow and storm and blizzard. It was basically the demons of the mountain where he was staying, trying to, you know, knock him off from, you know, making progress in his Dharma life. The Maras all around. And Milarepa sings this song of sort of triumph against this blizzard, this internal and external blizzard. And he uses this phrase, the only phrase actually I can remember, I read this song a long, long time ago. He said, the cotton cloth I wore, because Milarepa only wore a white cotton cloth, being a Kagyu yogi, a proper Kagyu yogi from those days. The cotton cloth I wore, Repa means a cotton cloth wearer, the cotton cloth I wear was like a burning brand, was like a burning brand. So his white cotton cloth was protecting him from the storm. He was doing his inner heat practice. But metta develops heat. Metta develops strong positive emotion against the storm. Standing up to the cold winds, the cold blast, melting the frosty forces around you that would destroy your Dharma life. It's interesting, the stage in the traditional description of the stages that corresponds to positive emotion in the five paths is called prayoga, the prayoga marga, the path of energetic effort. And it's said, this stage, the path of energetic effort to lead to the state of heat, the state of tapas, the state of heat. And this is what we're doing in positive emotion. We're getting to the stage of heat. And heat melts. Heat melts the rigidity of self. It melts the preciousness of self. It makes you more expansive. It makes you go out into your environment a lot more. It makes you embrace the people around you, the world around you. It makes you, therefore, robust. It makes you, enables you to stand up to whatever arises. It's also a way of making you strong for the reception of insight, of seeing things as they really are, of having insight into the real nature of life, impermanent, insubstantial, unsatisfactory, shunyata, emptiness, in other words, spiritual death, which I'll be talking about the day after tomorrow, spiritual death and rebirth. Without the robustness that comes through mindfulness and positive emotion, we cannot receive the insight. It will destroy us. It will destroy us negatively. We won't be able to withstand, if you like, spiritual death. We won't go through the transfiguration of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. It will lead us into, well, even psychosis. Sometimes, or we'll just squander the experience. We will seize on it, we will get conceited about it, and then we'll forget about it. I've met many people who've told me, sitting in this very room, how they've become irreversible on the path to enlightenment, or the bodhicitta has arisen, or fabulous visions of Buddhas and bodhisattvas. I've actually met many people like that who've completely given up any kind of spiritual life. That's because they weren't prepared for what they saw. I'm quite sure they saw something. I'm quite sure something happened. But actually, they didn't have, if you like, not just the consciousness, but in a sense the culture, the training to absorb what had happened. It became a kind of ego trip. After becoming an ego trip, it was something to forget about. They'd gone through that stage, and now they go back to living a thoroughly worldly life. It doesn't matter whether or not you have great visionary experience, it's what you do with it. It's what you do with it is what counts. So, yes, we need to really dwell in mindfulness and metta and strong positive emotions, so that we become robust, and yes, so that we generate the desire for the Dharma. There is not just one positive emotion. In a way, even the phrase positive emotion, I don't particularly like. It's not particularly poetic. We're talking about a whole range of emotions, a whole spectrum of emotions, a whole set of responses that arise in certain situations. This is what happens when you develop metta and the other positive emotions. You have access to a whole range of things, and I want to talk about the sort of range of emotions that sort of arise. Very important one is gratitude. And again, Satyaraj has mentioned gratitude, I think, today. I've lost the sense of time a bit, but you know how gratitude can lead to the arising of metta. And gratitude is regarded of supreme importance in Buddhist tradition. Somebody was reminding me yesterday that there is a story of the Buddha sitting after his enlightenment, gazing at the Bodhi tree in a state of gratitude to the tree that protected him, that supported him in his attainment of enlightenment. So this is an enlightened being feeling grateful to a tree for looking after him. His enlightened consciousness sees what he's been given, how he's been benefited. The word for gratitude in Sanskrit is katanyata, kritagnana in Sanskrit, katanyata in Pali. And it means something like recognition of benefits received. But you could say a loving recognition of benefits received, of how you've been enriched. And if we sat down and went through our life, we would see so many people who've enriched us. Starting with our parents, they've given us life. Okay, they might not have been very good parents. They might have been, in a sense, very bad parents. I know a lot of people, I personally had wonderful parents. I'm very grateful to my parents. I felt they definitely sacrificed their happiness at times for mine. They lived for me, but they certainly gave me life. They brought me into this world. So it's very important to feel gratitude to one's parents, to bring them to mind. In Tibetan Buddhist practice, they say that all beings have been your parents at one time or another. They have this idea of rebirth. One time or another, every single being, even the people here, have been your mum and dad. Maybe that's not a happy thought for you. If that doesn't do it for you, you can still feel, it's still important to go through all the people that have benefited you, that have brought you to this moment. I mean, one person I've got in mind at the moment, or a couple of people I'm particularly aware of, are our cooks, Ben and Diagina, producing this extraordinary food evening after evening. And Ben is quite new to cooking, and he's sort of flying solo at the moment. And you know, it's just they give us life. They give without that food, we wouldn't be having this retreat. We have a retreat leader. We have Satyaraja. Wonderful, beautiful introductions to practice, and an example. The way he sits, so he sits so still, so absorbed. You know, it's such an example of how to run a retreat. I don't think I've ever been on a retreat led by you before, Satyaraja. And it's, I've missed out. You know, we can feel really so grateful to that. And then you could go through, just so many people that have made Padmaloka. Mm. Aloka has done all this art, for us. And it goes on and on and on. This sort of state of gratitude. And I think if I could just give myself over to gratitude, Sangharakshita. Without Sangharakshita's blessing, I certainly wouldn't be saying any of these things to you. You know, Padmaloka wouldn't exist without Sangharakshita. He got Padmaloka, and so on and so forth, going right back to the Buddha. So if you're struggling with metta, maybe it's because you're not recognising, we're not recognising, if we're struggling with metta, we're not recognising how we've been enriched how we are already enriched. I think the modern world encourages an impoverished mentality. It really does encourage that. We're made to feel as though we don't have enough. We're made to feel that we've got to have this next thing. It's so deeply tragic. Whereas the classic Buddhist tradition is that we have been given so much. I think in the Zen tradition, I'm right in thinking that you even bow to your cushion before you sit down, out of gratitude for the cushion that supports you in meditation and is giving you the opportunity to gain enlightenment. So everything is giving to us all the time. So maybe we should meditate on this a lot more than we do. So gratitude is a supremely important positive emotion, which we could do with dwelling on a lot more. Another positive emotion that's very important is forgiveness. Forgiving other people their faults or wrongs that we think that they've done to us. An incredibly important positive emotion, this. And the Buddha is incredibly clear in the Dhammapada. After the first two verses on mind, you get two verses which are really to do with resentment, which go, those who entertain such thoughts as he or she abused me, they beat me, they robbed me. He who entertains such thoughts will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. As if the Buddha is saying, after you've taken responsibility for your mental states, after you've seen that skillful states of mind lead to happiness, unskillful states of mind lead to suffering, the sign of that, the sign of that insight, the sign of that taking up of the Buddhist path is the putting down of resentment. That's the immediate thing that you do. If you're entertaining resentment, you don't have any insight. You don't have any understanding of the Dharma. Sangsara is the tendency to find fault with others, sings the great tantric master Naropa. Sangsara is the tendency to find fault with others, to find fault with other people, to find fault with life. So you need to forgive. You need to forgive life. You need to recognise that hatred, it just does not do any good. Resentment does not do any good. Doesn't matter how much you've been wronged, how much difficulty that has been thrown your way, you will not solve the problem through trying to get payback. You will just eat yourself up and you'll have negativity towards other people. Hatred never ceases through hatred here in this world. It only ceases through love. This is an eternal dharma. This is an eternal law. That's the next verse in the Dhammapada. It's so important, this forgiveness. You know, for complete forgiveness of whatever's been done to you, whatever has happened. And this is taken up consistently, you know, throughout Buddhist tradition. It's taken up again and again and again by all the great masters. Nobody will allow hatred and the desire for revenge and retaliation to stand. Nobody will allow grumbling and resentment towards life, you know, towards other people to stand. Nobody will say that is ever skillful. That's the Buddhist tradition. Shantideva takes it a really long way in the Bodhicaryavatara by saying that in actual fact, you need to revere all life, all human beings, all life whatsoever. And especially you revere people who harm you. Especially you revere them because they teach you metta, patience, forgiveness. They are like the Buddhas. Shantideva, who has immense devotion to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, says that all living beings are exactly like the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They are all worthy of reverence because they teach us how to love, and especially people who harm us, they teach us how to, you know, how to love, how to, you know, really transform this hatred into love. So That's something to really notice. What I notice in myself, I can't say that I have sort of venomous, hateful thoughts, although I have my moments. What I have is a sort of low-level grumbling in my mind, a low-level grumbling that can find expression in speech, complaining, moaning, this isn't good enough, he's not good enough, that's not good enough, all this sort of thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been a sort of tough day today, because I've noticed that. And I thought, well, this is just this shameful for somebody who's been practicing the Dharma for so long that I can still do this. Why am I not forgiving? Why am I not rejoicing in what I've been given? Why isn't there the gratitude? You know, my heroes are the people who respond with love and gratitude for the most appalling situations. They're my heroes. One of my favourite stories, I'm just going to come out with favourite stories tonight, is a great Afghani Sufi singer, Qawwali singer, Ahmad Shah, his name, wonderful Qawwali singer. And when the Taliban took over Kabul, he and his Qawwali troop were imprisoned, and because the Taliban banned all music, and the Qawwalis, being Sufis, were a particular target. And he was asked by an interviewer, so, well, how did you feel about that? What was it like being thrown into prison and badly treated because you were singing? And he laughed. He said, well, in our Sufi tradition we say, when the roof is off the house, the sun and the sky shine in more fully. So in the same way, when everything is taken away, Allah falls in, shines in more fully, more clearly, undiluted. When everything is taken away, the more they beat us, the louder we sang. The more they beat us, the louder we sang. So if you're finding, you know, that things are falling apart for you in your life, in your meditation, maybe you're on the end of some really difficult stuff, just bring this to mind. The more they beat me, the louder I will sing. In metta. In the metta bhavana. The more the intense the metta will be. This is a fantastic opportunity to be given this. To have everything taken away like this. Rejoice in the freedom. Because it's also showing you that there's no real refuge in this samsara. You know, sometimes it's even people that we thought that we loved, who can treat us, we feel, quite badly. Can seem to take away so much from us. They are our best teachers of all. That's when the love is really shining in, not from them, but from reality itself. So forgiveness, gratitude, forgiveness. And then I want to mention reverence. Reverence, as a translation of the Sanskrit word Gaurava, Pali word Gaurava. It's a lovely word, Gaurava. Gaurava means literally weighty or heavy. You revere, you venerate, you worship that which is weighty, that which is really weighty for you, which is weighty with quality, that which is sublime, that which you really look up to, which has a real presence of meaning and mystery and transcendence. And quality, that's what you revere. And you probably know that after his enlightenment, the Buddha wanted a man to revere. This is really extraordinary. He's enlightened. He's fully liberated from conditioned existence. But he reflects, it's dukkha. It's painful for a man not to be able to revere another man. Not to be able to look up, to worship, to honour. Another man, this is extraordinary. This is extraordinary. This is, you know, comes out of that rich Indian culture of that time, of the need for a teacher, a real spiritual friend, a master. To be masterless is a terrible thing. That's really to be alone in the universe. Not to have a master, a lord, that you can really serve, that you can really revere, who is worthy of all your revering, all your love, all your devotion. You know, because they really do have quality. You've seen that, they do have quality. So even the enlightened one, the Buddha, wants that, needs that. But he looks and sees no one. There is no one he can revere. He somehow knows that there is nobody, no man greater than him. He still, however, wants to revere. So he reflects, or rather he sees more deeply, and he sees, I will revere the Dharma. I will revere the truth, reality, things as they are, as if the Dharma is even greater than the Buddha. And you certainly get that impression sometimes, where the way the Buddha speaks about the Dharma, like the great and mighty ocean, vast and mysterious. Yes, he's a master of the Dharma, but he goes on more and more deeply into the realm, the endless ocean of the Dharma. So he decides he's going to revere and serve and worship and honour and rely on the Dharma for the rest of his days, which he does by communicating the Dharma endlessly to beings. We, of course, need beings to revere. We are not without those greater than us, higher than us, those worthy of worship. So we need to find someone, some being to revere, to worship, and develop, and to develop that revering and that worship. And of course, this is what we're doing in the puja. This is what we're doing in the Sevenfold Puja. And I want to just end this talk by talking a little bit about puja, because puja is such an important spiritual practice for the development of this, well, not just positive emotion, but very refined emotion, as well as deep emotion, as well as stirring and thrilling emotion. It's also the way of developing and deepening our reverence for the Buddha, for the Bodhisattvas, well, the Buddha's plural, for the great teachers, in a sense, for everybody. That's what we're doing in a puja. And I'm sure that those of you who've done Mitra study have gone through the module on puja and so on, and you sort of, in a way, know what it's about, and we're doing it every evening. But it's well worth, I think, going back to what the puja really is. Sometimes people complain about the puja, oh, it doesn't really suit my needs, and can't we sort of jazz it up a bit with a bit of drumming and dancing and getting a little bit jiggy, you know, and all this sort of thing. Before they've really reflected deeply, seriously, on the nature of the puja, that's what we need to do first of all. So I want to go through the puja a little bit, you know, to help us in the development of this deeper, more refined emotional life that we're developing. So we come into the shrine room, don't we? And the first thing that we do when we come in is usually, if we remember, sometimes we don't, we bow, don't we? Really, before we come into the shrine room, we should already be working. We should be imagining that this is the Gandakuti, the perfumed chamber in which the Buddha lives. This is where the tradition of puja comes from. In India, every monastery had a Gandakuti, had a Buddha room, the place where the Buddha lived. They had an image for it, but of course, the monks, the bhikshus, the lay people that came, they weren't just, it wasn't just a bit of art or something like that. The rupa would have had would have a life for them. It would have a kind of quality of the living presence of the Buddha. Now, you might not like the sound of this, but just try it sometimes as a sort of exercise. If you like, you could regard the Sevenfold Puja as sort of imaginal yoga. You know, we're used to physical yoga, where you put the body in certain postures and so on, and that has a particular kind of effect. Well, there's another thing, another kind of yoga called imaginal yoga, where you are putting your body and your mind in a particular place, but to open up to particular range of responses. What you need to imagine when you come into the shrine room is that you're coming into the presence of the Buddha. You're coming into the presence of the Buddha. You're in a different space. So a very good idea is to not talk for quite a while before coming over. And you can, there's this lovely circumambulation you can do around Dada Rinpoche's stupa, and then come in and just gather very, very quietly, waiting for Satyaraja to come in. Satyaraja comes in and he salutes, doesn't he? Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Nama, and so on. And those little phrases are said to make immediately present the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, more vividly present. As soon as we say those phrases, we should feel that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are really there. We're really in their presence. And then we take our seat, we take our places to perform the puja. And there's a mudra that we have when we perform the puja. You know, the body makes a gesture to contact a particular mood, a particular emotion, the emotion of, well, of devotion. And this is the Anjali mudra, the mudra of worship and salutations. I've noticed there's a sort of fashion of people doing pujas with the dhyana mudra, or with their hands on their knees. It's up to you what you do, but this mudra is specific to generate a particular mood. And then we go through the stages of the sevenfold puja. And Sangharakshita has a quite wonderful insight into the puja. He says it's a sequence of seven devotional moods. Seven devotional moods. We're trying to contact moods. I think he has in mind the whole Indian notion of raga. You know, the raga that you get in Indian music. Raga means mood in this context. You know, you get ragas for dawn, you get ragas for the middle of the day, you get ragas for sunset, night ragas, you get ragas for the different times of year. Indian aesthetics is highly developed in that way. You also have the notion of rasa, taste, which is a way of talking about the different sort of flavours of aesthetic experience. And I think Sangharakshita is very knowledgeable of, not just knowledgeable, but has partaken very deeply of Indian culture, of culture generally. And I think this is what he's got in mind with the puja. Through the words, the poetry of the puja, we're trying to contact, we're opening up to these moods, these flavours, which are transformative. We're opening up to a whole different set of emotions. We're not forcing it to happen. There's no need to force it. The work's done. The words are by Shantideva, a great bodhisattva. They're his puja. All we have to do is sort of open up to the words. I have to admit that it's not great poetry. You know, it would be wonderful if we could have a puja equivalent of the, you might not like the sound of this, the Book of Common Prayer or the Bible, the James Bible, you know, something like that. This is for the English among you. You know, really great poetry, but we're not there yet. You know, it's going to take a while to do that, but it's good enough. It's good enough. You can really feel something through these words. So really, you know, really, really reflect on this as you recite the words. And the first stage is worship, puja. Puja just means worship. And it consists in the imagination of offerings. It's another very important part of puja. Your imagination should be working. You're not just reciting the words, you're seeing what's happening. And worship, even in our own English word we have it, you worship that which has worth, that which has value, that which has quality. For Buddhists, for those who go for refuge to the Buddha, the Buddha is of supreme quality. Supreme quality, supreme beauty. This is something that we don't often realise, but the Buddha is the beautiful one. There are many, many stories where people are just stunned by the Buddha's beauty. It's sort of spiritual beauty, just shining through. They're just stunned by that. There's just this immediate kind of fascination and captivation. And the response is to bow down and sometimes to offer, to give things, very practical things like water to drink or to wash with, or cloths and, you know, food, things like that. In our puja, we're immediately in the realm of the archetypal, because the second word of the puja is Mandarava, with Mandarava, blue lotus and jasmine. A Mandarava is a gigantic golden orange flower the size of a cartwheel. And these apparently float down in Mahayana sutras. So immediately you're imagining the most stupendous offerings. It's not ordinary flowers that you want to offer. You want to offer the most wonderful flowers imaginable, cosmic flowers to the Buddha. Only that is good enough. So with Mandarava, blue lotus and jasmine. Well, imagine that. Imagine the smells, the scents of those flowers. And it goes on, all of the other things that are mentioned in the puja. You're offering the most wonderful things up to the most wonderful being that you can imagine. And it brings you closer. It brings you closer to the Buddha in doing that. It's a very, very natural response to want to offer to that which we revere. And of course, you can also make actual offerings, you know, our more humble offerings of the lights that we have here. But it's good to bring offerings, as Satyaraja said. You know, find lovely things, but try to imagine how they would please the Buddha if he was sitting here. Try to imagine things that would really please the Buddha. Try to feel that, you know, what would that enlightened being really like and really respond to? So first of all, there's worship, getting in touch with that mood. And there's a real courtesy to this stage of the puja, and sort of skill, with garlands skillfully woven, which describes the whole sort of flavour of the way in which we move in the puja and in the shrine room generally. There's real sort of courtesy and care. We're not sloppy in the shrine room. This is something I noticed in India, even with very, very, very poor people, how much more cultured than me they were. Just the way they would greet me, the way that the hospitality, the way they would treat me, so much more developed than the most sort of cultured person you would find very often in the West. You know, their culture was in the way they treated the guest, the stranger, the person who was, you know, the foreigner who come to their place and graced them. So in the worship section, try and contact that mood. Then there's Vandana, salutation. The Buddha might be supremely beautiful and you want to beautify him with offerings. But in the Vandana section, you recognize that the Buddha is vast and sublime, and so, so far beyond you, beyond us. It's like you've sort of got closer, a bit like you've got closer to a beautiful mountain that you've seen in the distance, and then as you get closer, you realise it's just sort of towering up in front of you, completely dwarfing you, awing you, creating this sort of awe and veneration in you. So in the Vandana section, you're getting that sense of the sublime. And Vandana is a prostration. You just want to go down. You just want to salute, because you recognise, well, enlightenment is just so far away. I'm just tiny in comparison. You know, and you feel this sense of real reverence and veneration at the mystery and depth of enlightenment. It's like encountering a great surging ocean or something like that. I remember many years ago being at on an ordination course at Gukhiloka, and Sangharakshita was there, and he came up for dinner with us, and we were having a discussion after dinner. And at that time, one of the sort of fashions that sort of sweeps through our Tri Ratna order every 5 minutes Well, the fashion at that time, amazing how these go, was Buddha Nietzsche. That was very, very fashionable. Everybody going on about, well, you know, I'm finding it really helpful, you know, to find that I'm enlightened already, you know, and it's just there, you know, enlightened already. And I just need to kind of peel it all back and I'm enlightened, you know, and people talking like this. And so people were asking Sangharakshita about this. And it was really interesting to hear him talk, because he said, well, of course, yes, we have the potential for enlightenment. Of course we do. There's something in us that responds to enlightenment. That's Shraddha. That's our response to enlightenment, of course. But he said, really? The Buddha, with all his powers and virtues and depths and qualities, said, no, I don't think that he is present, you know, fully in us. I don't think that. And I realised when he was talking, this man knows the Buddha. This man knows the Buddha. Buddha nature, for everybody else at this table, is an idea. It's a nice idea to make them feel better about themselves. This man really knows the Buddha. He knows how vast and how deep and how great the Buddha really is, how sublime the Buddha is, and how far the Buddha is from us, from him even. Gave me enormous confidence in him. We don't get nearer to the Buddha by some trick of the mind, by sort of saying we are him already in some way. Strange to say, when we realise how far the Buddha is from us, strange to say, he's sort of nearer to us. Strange to say, if we think he's near, he's probably far, if you see what I mean. So in this Vandana section, we're developing this deep reverence and salutation to the Buddha, and there's nothing to be frightened of with that. It's such a relief to acknowledge somebody greater than you. It's such a wonderful feeling to say, this person, this man, this being, this state is greater than I. I mean, for a start, you can give up competing. Isn't it fantastic? What a relief. You don't have to compete. They're greater. They're better at meditation than I am. You know, they're much great. They're much more loving than I am. Wow, fantastic. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Good thing. You know, there's somebody better than me. Many better than me. So it goes cosmic in this part of the puja. You know, as many atoms as there are in the 1,000,000,000 worlds. Well, imagine that. So many times I make reverent salutation. It's said in some texts, you should imagine loads and loads of versions of yourself throughout the cosmos, prostrating at this point. This is what they say. Fantastic, isn't it? Isn't that amazing? Doing all these prostrations to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, places where the Bodhisattvas have been. That's where particularly the Buddha in previous lives has been, in India. But you can imagine Bodhisattvas have been here. Sangharakshita has been here. He's a Bodhisattva. Dada Rinpoche's stupa is out here. But Dada Rinpoche is a Bodhisattva. We bow to them. And then I love this phrase, and those to whom respectful salutation is due. And I think of everybody when I do that, particularly my brothers in the Sangha. I think of everybody in the shrine room when in that part of the puja. Everybody here is worthy of respectful salutation, because everybody here is practicing. Everybody here is making an effort. Everybody here is worthy of reverence and salutation. So, you know, wherever you see greatness, you revere it, you salute. That's what we're doing. That's the mood. Then there is going for refuge. Going for refuge. And here, okay, the Buddha is far. The Dharma is deep. The Sangha is vast. Nonetheless, we go for refuge. We make the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha the centre of our lives. We commit ourselves to gaining enlightenment, to becoming, in the end, like the Buddha, becoming enlightened ourselves, the fullness of wisdom and compassion, whatever it takes. We go for refuge to the Dharma to do whatever it takes to practice the path that leads to that enlightenment. We go for refuge to the Sangha to join with all of those who are going for refuge. On whatever level they're on, the great saints, the great bodhisattvas, the stream entrants and so on, and everybody else, whoever is committed, we join with them to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. This is an extraordinary thing. You know, to that act of commitment. In a way, it's sort of easy to worship. In a way, it's easy to revere and salute. It's harder to make the commitment. To stand up, to go for refuge, to publicly go for refuge. This is, of course, what order members do, the Dharmacharis here, looking around the room. The thing about the guys with cases here, the order members with the names, the thing about them is that, looking at them all, these are all seriously committed men. Seriously committed to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. They're not, I don't know. But perhaps they're not highly spiritually advanced. None of them would claim to be, you know, great teachers, full of insight and all the rest of it. They don't operate like that. We don't operate like that. The thing is, they're committed. They're committed to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. They're committed to a path. They're committed to the path that Sangharakshita has taught. This is a really wonderful thing. These are the spiritual friends that we need to make that commitment. And the thing about it, looking around at everybody in the room here and considering myself, when we came along, we were all very, very rough and ready. Very, very rough and ready indeed. Really kind of, some of us even, you know, really quite messed up, or callow youths in my case, with a lot to work on. I know sometimes people wonder, oh, I couldn't do that. I couldn't live like that. I couldn't live a committed life like that. I couldn't make that kind of public commitment. But that's not true. Every human being is capable of making a commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Of actually, if you like, putting a stake down, in the sense of a sort of gambler puts a stake down. This is my life. Whatever happens, I'm going to follow the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. I'm going to live this path. I'm going to go for refuge. This is what we're doing in the third stage of the puja. It's a great sort of turning point in the puja. Then there's confession of faults. After you go for refuge, the immediate thing that you become aware of are your faults. It's all the baggage and rubbish and cack that that's just you, and it's just between you and the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It often happens when people have either been invited to be ordained, or after they've been ordained, they suddenly go, oh no, what have I done? What have I done? They've just become aware of all their failings and faults. You know, and it's true of every time you step out and make a commitment to something, you become aware of your faults and failings. This is a good thing. This is a very, very good thing, to become aware of our faults. In the puja, we call it papa deshana, confession of faults or confession of evil. I want to say something about this word evil, because some people say, well, we shouldn't have the word evil in the puja. You know, I'm not evil, and they're not evil, and that sounds like Christianity. But you know, it's very, very hard to translate this word papa, is the word in Sanskrit, with any other word. It's a very, very weighty word that's being used. So evil is the only possible translation. And deshana, if confession is a good word, it literally means pointing out. So you point out to yourself, in relation to the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, spiritual friends, those things that you see that are obstructing you on the path to enlightenment. Now, why this word evil? Why can't we just say faults or mistakes or little difficulties? Well, I think it's actually to do with the mood. The text that this comes from, the Bodhicharavatara, his puja is performed after the great bodhicitta has arisen, the will to enlightenment for all beings. It's assuming that there's already this upsurging of this tremendous commitment to follow the path to enlightenment for all beings. And with that tremendous vision, there's a highly attuned sensitivity to unskillful behaviour, to all those things that are actually going to prevent you not just bringing about your own liberation, but enabling others to follow the path as well. All those things which make you fall asleep. All those things which can't be that good at all. Sorry, I got distracted there for a minute. That's my fault. So you become very, very sensitive. And when you become sensitive to your unskillful action, you can't just call it a fault or a mistake. You need a weighty word for it. You need something much, much stronger than that. It just won't do to just call it, oh, well, it's a little bit of a fault. This is strong stuff. It's in the way of what I'm really trying to do. And I think one of the reasons is we don't really understand just how unenlightened we are. We don't really get how ignorant we are. You know, if we didn't have, you know, really serious unskillfulness, we would be enlightened. We would be enlightened. We need to take the stuff that's holding us back much, much more seriously than we do. So that's why we use the word evil, you know, in this part of the puja. Also, the other thing is I think we're extraordinarily complacent. I know for myself that I'm not convinced that I couldn't kill somebody. I think that under certain circumstances, if I was threatened, or if a loved one was threatened, I think I could easily kill. I could seriously break the first precept. Don't worry, I don't think I'm a homicidal maniac. I'm talking about under certain conditions. I'm very conscious, well, actually not conscious enough, of being protected by a relatively stable environment. I don't live in a civil war zone, for example. I don't live in a place where my neighbours could turn on me. Friends in India live next door to neighbours who will get on, they'll get on fine while there's no ethnic strife. But if there was Hindu and Muslim and even Buddhist, you know, ethnic strife that would kick off, you could easily be hacked to death by your neighbour who's actually nice to you the day before. That's possible. That happens. I know people who've been in that. I'm not confident that I haven't got those forces. I think I've got those forces in me. So whilst I have ill will, there's always the potentiality of doing great evil. So I really want to work on that. I want to expunge that from my consciousness. I want to purify that. I want to lay it bare. So that's what we're doing in the fourth stage of the puja, confessing our faults, confessing our evil. Maybe later on in the retreat this will get a bit stronger. This confession of faults practice, I should say, is taken to the level of sort of insight and wisdom. There's a sutra called the Sutra of Golden Light, which has a whole chapter on confession, which is like the sort of vomiting up of all the roots of unskillfulness in your being. That's what you're doing. You're laying it bare with wisdom's blaze. That's what you're doing. So that's what we're moving towards in the confession of fault section. Very, very strongly contacting, you know, a sense of remorse about what we've done and making a commitment to really do something about it. Taking ourselves seriously, taking our commitment seriously. Then you've got a really happy stage. You sort of need it afterwards. But the happy stage comes naturally after getting rid of the sort of all that stuff that's, you know, in the way. You look around and you can rejoice. You can be glad at the good all around you, the good in you. The good in you, yes. Not only do you have unskillfulness, you have enormous potential, an actual good that you do. I rejoice with delight in the good done by all beings. Well, you are one of the all beings. It's not just everybody else, it's you as well. Rejoicing in everybody, in the good that's done all around you. And then, of course, rejoicing in the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the Dharma. Rejoicing in the arising of this great bodhicitta, this wonderful thing, this movement towards wisdom and compassion, which one can open up to and be transformed by. So this fifth stage of the puja is this rejoicing. Then comes adyasana yachana, which means entreaty and supplication. In some ways, the whole puja is leading up to this point where you're asking, you're entreating, you're being supremely receptive and strongly desiring the Buddhas to be present to you. You want them to, you want to have an actual encounter with the Buddha, with enlightenment itself. So it's quite important to look back through the stages of the puja. It's all leading up to this desire to have the Buddha with you, present in some way, and not leave. You know, I think this probably goes back to stories in the sutras. You know, that people really didn't want the Buddha to enter parinirvana. Okay, yes, they're told that all things are impermanent and all the rest of it, and the Buddha tells them that enough. But nonetheless, imagine it, that your teacher, who you love so much, is going, is leaving you. Well, unless you're an arahant, already enlightened, well, you won't feel that there's any departure. You know, the Buddha hasn't gone. You'll always be with the Buddha because you're sharing that enlightenment. But if you're not that, you're going to feel it. You'll feel that enlightenment has left you. So in this sixth stage of the puja, we're asking enlightenment to stay. We're asking the Buddha to stay, and we're asking him to teach so that life in this world does not grow dark. Not just this world, yeah? It's not just for us, it's for the whole world. We want the Dharma to be for everybody. So we move. It's the puja isn't just about our own welfare. We want the light of the Dharma to be shining for everybody. And then after the entreaty, and it's an urgent entreaty, yes, there's real receptivity there, but it's urgent. You really want the Dharma to shine. You need the Dharma. So it's also going against this complacency, you know, that we so often take for granted the conditions that we have. It's really going against that. You want the Dharma to really shine and to last. But after that, we then have the reading. And the reading is really important. This is the teaching of the Buddha for this occasion. So we should be really listening. It's not a time for shuffling around and spacing out, but for hearing. Really hearing the Dharma. And sometimes if you've done the puja really well, the teaching goes right in, right to the core. We also have the Heart Sutra at this point after the reading, or sometimes you'll just have the Heart Sutra. And this is even more extraordinary. Well, it is pretty extraordinary because the words of the Heart Sutra are said by no one less than Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. This is compassion speaking. Compassion, love speaking. We need to imagine this. This is compassion seeing through the distinction between self and other with that recitation of the Heart Sutra. Sometimes it's good to have a more literal translation of the Heart Sutra read. You know, and we just listen to it. Listen to how Avalokiteshvara speaks. You know, and we open up to that very mysterious, you know, vision of things. Then we emerge. And we emerge in the last stage, the last mood of the puja, is the transference of merit and self-surrender. And here, the whole idea is, this word merit, I find rather ugly, actually. It's a translation of punya. And unfortunately, it has this idea that you've got a sort of merit bank, which you're sort of dropping your little, you know, merit chips in, which you can sort of cash in at the end of the casino of life. Just make that. But it's not actually like that. Punya, Sangharakshita speaks of it, I mean, in a way, good would be a better translation, but Sangharakshita says punya is more like an aura or a momentum. It's more like the virtues that you develop through your spiritual practice, the good vibes that happen, the good things that come, the qualities even that you develop, you know, through your Dharma life. You know, and you notice this. People develop good qualities through their Dharma life. Maybe they came along a bit messed up, and you know they practice the Dharma, and you know things get good, and then they give it up and you know go and you know go for the world. Well, that's kind of missing the point. The whole idea of Dharma practice is that you develop the good, you develop the virtue and the merit, in order that you may give it, that you may give yourself. That's what you're really doing with transferring merit. You're giving the good that you have for the benefit of everybody, all life whatsoever. You're giving it away. So it's a wonderfully generous, expansive act and imagining that we're doing at the end of the puja. It goes even further because there's a self-surrender. Wow. Self-surrender. You're giving up yourself for the good of all. You're becoming like the elements of earth and water and fire and air to serve and maintain all of life until all living beings have entered nirvana. That's the peace at the end of the puja. In other words, at the end of the puja, we're sort of taking the bodhisattva vow. We're sort of collectively, all together, saying that actually this Dharma life, it's not just about me. It's not just about this week. It's not just about this individual lifetime. This is going to go on and on and on. There's an endless end. It's not even about gaining an enlightenment that will just be for me or anything like that. It's about everything I do being of service to the good of all life, so that all life grows and develops and moves on towards, yes, even enlightenment itself. That all of life, in some strange way, will, yes, become enlightened, so that this entire world will become a Buddha field, a pure Buddha land. It might seem a sort of impossible dream, but is there anything else worth doing? Is there anything else worth living for? You know, working to gain enlightenment yourself, to transform yourself, to attain the great bliss, and share it with everybody else? Is it? I can't think of anything better, actually. You know, through all the ups and downs, all the scrapes, all the blizzards, all the journeys, there's no other life than that. And, you know, I know we can get a bit down sometimes and, you know, think that we're a particularly, you know, fallen sort of individual or something like that. But remember what Sangharakshita said, you know, well, you never know. How do you know that you're not actually a bodhisattva? How do you know that you're not a bodhisattva who's having a bit of an off life? You know, you might be that. We might be that. You know, we're just, we've been really doing it in the past. But for one reason or another, maybe we got into trouble with an Egyptian slave girl or something like that. We didn't transmute it and transform it. So we're having a bit of an off life for a while. But don't worry, you're getting back onto the bodhisattva groove. But anyway, in the last stage of the puja, you're giving it all away, dedicating your life to the service of all. In a way, you're coming to the end of language with the last stage of the puja. It's unimaginable, that kind of life of service and self-surrender. You're going beyond self and other and words and so on. So then, what is there to do? What you then have to contemplate is the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. So we have the mantras, these sound symbols. This is what that life is like. That's what we're doing. We're practicing what the bodhicitta, this consciousness of wisdom and compassion, how it crystallizes into all these different forms, how it manifests in, well, these are just some of the forms. Actually, it's infinite the way enlightenment will manifest out of compassion for all beings. And it's doing that out of skillful means for us, so that we can, reality will always sort of clothe itself, manifest itself, embody itself for our benefit, so that we can relate to it. You might find that there are particular forms that are particularly attractive, that really excite your desire. That's a good thing. That's a very good thing. That's a doorway. That's your gateway into enlightenment, into bodhicitta, into the life of self-surrender. That's a wonderful thing if you find that. That's why we have this room with these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So chant the mantras in full awareness that these sounds are the sounds of the bodhicitta, the sounds of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and let them resonate through you, transforming you, changing you. You know, and then we get to the shantis. We're going even further to the edge of language. The three shantis, which are the complete pacification of craving, hatred, and delusion in Buddhahood itself. In the peace that passeth all understanding, in biblical phrase. That's what we're entering into. And as Satyaraja said, we should just sit. This might be apocryphal, but one order member told me that Bhante Sangharakshita once said to him, really, you shouldn't move for 2 hours after the three shantis. You know, it should be that deep, that profound. You know, if we're really doing the puja, chanting the mantras, chanting the shantis. Well, maybe 2 minutes, that's a start. And I know some people have been sitting on, not knowing, on this retreat, not knowing that actually everybody's left. Wonderful, wonderful, marvellous. So that's the stage of positive emotion. That's how we can practice to... Well, we're not just developing robust emotion. I think if we really live like this, we really will be, you know, towards the end of the path. But there you are.
Thank you very much for that.